My name's Ray Moss, and I'm a responsible alcoholic. Hello, folks. What a fellowship. Betty and I drove in here yesterday afternoon about 3 o'clock, had a great trip down, and were met by some wonderful folks and have spent these last hours just getting acquainted with everybody and having a wonderful time. I want to thank you for inviting me. Bert, I want to thank you and the committee especially for the invitation and for your hospitality. It's been wonderful, and Betty and I have enjoyed every minute of it so far. I look forward to the rest of it. It's always good to be with my friends, Bob here and his wife Ruth with B&R Tapes. We've known Ruth for a long time. And Bob introduced me to a segment of recovery that I didn't know a number of years ago. He introduced me to some tapes. I didn't listen to tapes, but I do now, and I hear people from all over the country. Sometimes I wish I could hear somebody from Oregon, and I'll ask Bob and he gives me some tapes, or I ask for special tapes and he lets me have those. If you haven't gotten into that, you ought to try it. And Bob will also helps me a great deal. Every time I go somewhere and he's taping, he helps me remember how long I'm supposed to talk. He reminded me a while ago that he had a 60-minute, a 72-minute, and a 90-minute tape. And I said to him, better keep all three of them on hand. I'm not sure. Bob, I want to thank you for helping me. This is probably one of the best organized groups we've been in. We go everywhere and everything's just being done. So many folks wearing the name tags. Committee, I think everybody's a committee. You know, I run into you everywhere. Your hospitality is wonderful. Betty and I get to go, great privilege, 8-10 of these a year for the last while, and it's just a joy to be in this one. What wonderful facilities this is. I'm trying to talk a little bit so I can settle down. You know, I don't know. I've been doing this kind of stuff 38 years, not AA talking, but I've been before people for almost 40 years, but I still get nervous. Let me tell you a little story. Maybe it'll settle me down a little bit. I like this because it says some things to me. It was told to me by a lady up in Greenville, South Carolina. I want to share it with you. The telephone rings and a quiet little voice answers in a whisper, "Hello." And the person says, "May I speak to your mother?" "Mother's busy." "Well, who else is there?" "Daddy's here." "Well, let me speak to Daddy." "He's busy too." "Who else is there?"
"The firemen are here."
"Well, let me speak to the firemen."
"They're busy too."
"Who else is there?"
"The police."
"Well, let me speak to the police."
"They're busy."
And the voice says, "What are all those people doing?"
"They're looking for me."
I think the reason I like that story and like to tell it is that little fellow has characteristics that's going to get him here if he's not careful. I know exactly how long to talk. Bob really doesn't have to remind me because I learned it from an old preacher friend of mine years ago. He tells this. He says that when he'd go to a new church, he'd never look at his watch, and he'd always preach till 5 minutes till 12, have the benediction, and yet they'd get out of the church and get on down to Shoney's before the Baptist beat them there. And he did that Sunday after Sunday, and one of the old boys in the congregation came up to him one Sunday after service and said to him, "Reverend, I want you to tell me, how in the world do you stop every time 5 minutes till 12? You never look at your watch." And he said, "Well, it's just a secret of the trade I learned a long time ago." He said, "When I start talking, I put a cough drop in my mouth. And when that cough drop runs out, I just stop, wherever it is." And he thought, that's not a bad idea. A few Sundays after that, the old boy went to 12:15. 12:30 in the quarter of one, people started getting up, and so he just stopped. Realized he'd gone too long, and after the service was over, and same old boy came up to him and said to him, "Reverend, what in the world happened today? You went almost 45 minutes overtime." He said, "You know, I put a button in my mouth by mistake." I want to assure you that I've not done that. We're going to start on time. We're going to try to stop on time. I was raised in a textile town up in North Carolina. Some of you know about textiles because a fellow said, I heard you talk once, and I'm a textile man, so I know some of you know about that. I grew up in Kannapolis, North Carolina, where I'm now living. My daddy worked in textiles. My granddaddy, my mama, and all the folks that I knew, they worked in the mill. And I didn't like that. I did not like to be called a lint head. I didn't like the idea that I had to be associated with people who were looked at, as I thought, kind of down upon by other people. And coupled with that, my dad's is an alcoholic. And I didn't like that because if you grew up, if any of you know anything about the alcoholism in the family, you know that it was hell. Always confusion and frustration and arguments and never anything at peace. And so I didn't like where I was raised. I didn't like the people that raised me. I didn't like anything about life. I just was an unhappy young man. My dad was drank alcoholically for 62 years, according to his own words. I hated that man. I hated him more than any other person in the world. I grew up hating him. He was drafted into the Second World War right after 1941, right after the war started. And he was gone for about 4 years. And he served in the South Pacific, and I prayed for him every day while he was gone. I prayed that he'd die. I prayed that he would just get killed and never come back into that home. Well, he didn't die. But let me tell you what that did for me. It altered my whole concept of God as I understood him. God didn't answer prayers. God didn't hear me. God wasn't concerned, so I didn't concern myself with God either. And from that moment or those days on, I did not associate with God. My dad was a periodic drinker. I learned how to drink from him. And I never altered that plan across the years. I just drank like he taught me how to drink. Now, he didn't know he was teaching me how to drink, but I grew up in a little mill village house. We had 3 rooms, no bath, and a path. And my dad couldn't drink in that house. Mama wouldn't let him. Mama was a strong lady, and she controlled that place. She wouldn't let him drink there. But he could drink in what I have learned in the last few years to be a place where he considered it his bar or his lounge, a little 3x5 pantry that was attached to the kitchen where Mama kept her lard and her flour and meal and all the good spices and stuff that she made stuff with. Dad had a place to drink there, and his bar was on the back of the pantry down on the floor in a jar, in a bottle, or in a bag. And he'd shut that door when he went in, and he'd unscrew the cap off of that fruit jar, and he'd turn it up, and I'd hear him take a drink, shake, moan, groan, go on and say, God, that's good. And come out, and about the third time in, he'd forget to shut the door. I watched him. I liked the way he handled himself right after he had a drink. I liked the way he felt, the way he looked like he felt. And he'd want to dance with Mama, and Mama wouldn't dance with him. And he'd want to love up with Mama, and she wouldn't love up with him. But he felt good. And she wouldn't dance, so he'd get a broom. And I've watched him dance all around the kitchen table and around the chairs with a broom in his hand. And I thought that's the craziest old fool I'd ever seen in my life. But, you know, I drank enough liquor, and nobody around to dance with me. I've danced with the broom myself a lot of times. I learned to drink from Dad. One day I said, if he's not home, Mama's not here, I'm going to have some of that stuff that makes him feel so good for at least a little while before he took off. They were gone, and I unscrewed the top off that jar and took me a drink. And it did for me right then exactly what it did for me as long as it worked. I don't believe it made me feel good. I can't ever remember a drink ever making me feel good. But let me tell you what it did for me, as it did for many of you. It helped me remember who I was. You see, when I had a drink, I didn't care that I was raised in a mill village. It didn't matter that I lived in Kannapolis. When I had a drink, it didn't make a bit of difference that my dad was a lint head or that I was a lint head. It didn't even matter that my dad was an alcoholic. I didn't even hate him when I had a drink. I loved the old boy. And Mama was okay when I had a drink. And you see, I pursued that almost to hell and back. Almost to death. When I had a drink, everything was okay. When I wasn't drinking, I was miserable. And that's the way my life ran. I was very fortunate. I met a young lady. She lived on the other side of the track. Kannapolis, North Carolina, is divided by the Southern Railway. One side of the town's on the south side, the other side's on the east side, or north side. And my wife, from the side of the town that I always believed that I'd like to live on. The mill villages were not there, the mill town, just a little section of it. But most of it was privately owned, and she came from a family that owned the house. And I thought she had the world by the tail. And she was pretty, too. And I started to move after her, and I got her, and we got married. Just turned 19. It's too young, but we did it. And we did what every young couple said they're going to do. I said I wasn't going to drink anymore. She didn't like it, and I wasn't going to do it. And I didn't for while I was around her. We got married, and about 3 years into that marriage, something happened to me that you'll understand what happened when I tell you. I was saved. I was converted. I had a Christian experience with God as I understood him in those days, and my life was totally changed. I didn't drink anymore. I didn't smoke anymore. I didn't dance. I didn't hardly ever look at women. But my life was changed, altered. And something happened about a year after that conversion experience that changed me forever, changed the whole pattern of my life. I answered the call to the Christian ministry, which meant I was going to train to become a Christian clergy person, a minister. I had to go back to school. I quit high school when I was 16, went to work in a cotton mill, which I said I never would do. I had to go back to high school, go to college, go to seminary, graduate school. I was a good, clean, Christian, living young man. Alcohol was not a part of my life. In fact, I even preached some awful good sermons against alcohol. Still got those sermons. They're not bad material. It's still pretty good stuff now. I was in my last year, for about 13, 14 years, I didn't drink, smoke, do any of those things that altered a person. I was playing golf with a young doctor last year in Duke Divinity School. I'd been driving 60 miles each way back and forth every day. I had two big old Methodist churches out in the country. I worked to death. I was stressed out. I'm a workaholic. I still had not taken care of any of my ism. I said to this young doctor, I was playing golf, Doc, I can't sleep at night. And he said to me, I can fix that. You come by my office, and he did. He gave me a little yellow Synchronol sleeping capsule, and I took it. Did for me exactly what I was supposed to, what it was supposed to, put me to sleep. Well, one didn't do it after a while, and I had to take two of them. And I did something that I had not done in years. I went back to see that doctor, and I said to him, you know, Bob, Betty threw that bottle away. And he said, that's not a problem. I was always blaming things on Betty. All of my life, all of my alcoholism was blamed on her. I drank because of her. I know that. But that was not the real reason, but that was a good excuse. He gave me another prescription. I've got one drugstore. I've got two drugstores, one doctor, and two prescriptions. And that began my addiction into alcoholism. I went crazy, as most people do. I began to do things that are not normal for clergy persons to do. I say this, and it was honest truth, but I want to say it a little jest if I can. I think a lady on the front row of the pew winked at me. I swear she did. And, you know, something happened, and I began, in an altered state of mind, I began to do things that preachers don't do. And that carried on a pattern for a long time. Not long after my drinking started, I said to this lovely lady that I'd married and loved very much, "Betty, I don't love you anymore." You see, it wasn't that I didn't love her. I just didn't know how to love her anymore. She was still good and honest, and I'm drinking and hiding it and confusing myself and her and getting the family all confused. And I thought if I was away from them, that things would be better. Now, when you tell somebody you don't love them, it's awfully difficult for them to love you. And we had a hard time together. In fact, we were separated and back together so many times that we lost track of it. Betty, once in a while, Betty and I sit down and try to think about it. It gets so confusing, we just simply forget it. We start laughing about it. But we were in and out of our marriage for a lot of times. Church didn't know what to do with me. It's awfully hard to know what to do with a drinking preacher. They might be able to handle us if they knew us drinking. But you know, we're good. I was very good at hiding and concealing. Nobody ever saw. Nobody ever caught me. The only person that knew it was Betty, and she's a family member. She's not going to tell anybody, and never did tell anybody. I used to have the hardest time buying liquor. I sat in envy of you folks. Y'all could just walk in a liquor store, pick up a bottle. You might even look at it. Look at the color, read the name, look at the ingredients. But that wasn't the way I did it. I had to sit sometimes for 20, 30 minutes out in front of one of those self-serve stores in North Carolina and watch. And when that store was empty, I'd run in. I'd pick it up, have the right change, let it down, run out. And one day I was hurrying out, and I ran into one of my church officials coming in. And he didn't speak to me, and I didn't speak to him, and we haven't spoken not about that to this day. Eventually, it caught up with me, of course. I made the decision to leave the pulpit ministry. You see, when you're preaching, or at least when I was preaching every Sunday down to people like I'm standing here, trying to talk about sin, that's the preacher's business. Well, it was awfully hard for me to talk about something that I was already involved in myself. I couldn't find too many things that I could talk about to those folks that I wasn't doing worse than they were. And you know, nobody knew it. Well, Betty and I finally just decided that we'd get a divorce. I had moved out of the pulpit ministry and working for the state of North Carolina in a very responsible job. It was a political job, but it was still responsible. One drunk gave another drunk a job. He'd gotten appointed by the governor, and he just thought, "I'd like to have that job," so I got me a nice job. And I decided that everybody working around me in the 70s were divorced. And Betty and I weren't getting along, so we just got us one. I went out and got it. We got our separation, and I went out and got a divorce. Let me tell you what I did. The first thing that I did, first two things, after leaving my family, to show you how sick I was. The first thing was I went out and found me a swinging singles apartment. I wanted to be where the action was. I was 44 years old, and I never swung in my life. We got married when I just turned 19, and I'd been a minister all my life, and I couldn't swing, and I really wanted to do some of that. The second thing I did was go buy me a bar. They don't furnish those with Methodist parsonages. They just don't do it. So I went out and bought me a bar, got me a swinging singles apartment in a place called, listen to this, the Hilton West. Doesn't that sound alcoholic? It was. It was very nice. Bought me a bar. Now, it wasn't really authentic. It had imitation leather. And it was just not imitation. It was imitation mahogany. It wasn't real stuff, but it was good. And in that house where I only had a chair and a mattress on the floor upstairs where I was going to do all my swinging, there sat one of the nicest bars you've ever seen. Now, I didn't know how to buy liquor. I'd never bought any alcohol except went in and went out, and now I didn't have a church. So I walked into this self-serve store, and I picked me up a buggy, and I walked around like I had some sense. And I pushed that buggy, and I wasn't afraid for anybody to see me because I did not have a church any longer. Nobody would know me, and it didn't make any difference if they did. And I didn't know what I was buying. I just bought it by the colors. And I took it home and put it in the liquor cabinet. I thought a whole lot of people were going to come see me. And I was going to do a lot of drinking with those folks. I learned something after I got sober. I learned that I never took a drink at that bar. I learned how I drank in that swinging singles apartment. Upstairs, back in the closet, far back as it could be, set a bottle in a bag. And when I wanted to drink, I carried the glass up, screwed the top off, stripped the bag down, poured me out a drink, put it back, walked back down, sat down in an old drinking chair and drank it, and made that trip how many times each night, I don't know. I never brought a woman in that place. I never did any swinging. I just simply did what an alcoholic like me does, and that is drink alone because of fear and guilt and remorse. Now, I had had one little table that had a drawer in it, a little shrine, really. And on that little table sat my two children's pictures. And I'd leave those out all the time. And along about the first fifth, I'd reach down with that crying jag on and pull the drawer open and set Betty's picture up in the middle of those two children. And I drank the rest of the evening looking at those pictures and crying. Well, that didn't last long. That swinging singles place was too expensive for me. I moved to, as alcoholics, we always go to extremes. And I moved into a senior citizen's retirement place. Cross town. Duplex apartment. No drinking. I finally found one little lady that would come drink with me. She'd drink two beers and go home. And nobody was talking to me in those days. It was running toward the end and nobody was talking. And Betty had already declared that if I called her anymore, she's going to call the police. And people out in the West Coast didn't like to be called at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know how that is. Ran across the phone bill the other day. The last phone bill I had, long-distance calls were over $390. People I didn't hardly know, and certainly people didn't want to hear from me. One night as I sat alone, and you know how lonely the alcoholic gets, don't you? 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and nobody will talk with us, and we're so lonely, and the alcohol's not working anymore. I got this grand idea that I'd get somebody over to talk to me. I loaded a double-barrel shotgun, buckshot, walked out of the front, out in front of that little duplex apartment, pulled down on the window with both barrels, shot the window out, ran back in the house, hid the gun, crawled into bed and fell out in the floor. Picked up the telephone and called the police and said to them, "Somebody's shooting at me." Now, I know you say he's crazy, but go on with me a little farther. You know? Let me finish this story. I'm in my right mind today, but not then. The police came, sirens whining, lights flashing. And they got out and they flashed their lights all around. Came in the house, and I'm praying to God they won't find the gun. I'm already into this thing now, and I really don't want to get locked up. When they started leaving about an hour later, there must have been 25 or 30 little senior citizens, men and women, standing out in front of that little duplex apartment. Now, for the next 6, 8 weeks, I had plenty of company. These little folks would come down, sit with me, and say, "Reverend, who do you think it was that shot at you?" Well, you know, an alcoholic drinking, I made that story get bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, the detective on the last trip said, as he started to leave, "You know, brother, I believe if I were you, I'd leave that man's wife alone." I'll tell you that story. I couldn't tell it for years. But I tell you that story because it helps me realize that that's not my insanity, but that was my craziness. My mind was totally, totally obscured from any rational decisions. I did things that could have put me in prison, and they had no rationale to them whatsoever. Alcoholism. Well, that job that I had with the state was about to run out because the politicians were about to change, and I needed another job. And also, I needed to make a change. I wanted it to be like it used to be. I wanted to go back to when I was a good man And I had a family with me, and I wanted to put things back together. So I made a trip down to see the bishop. Now, I'm a Methodist, and the bishop is, he controls the destiny of Methodist preachers. And I went down to a town about 65, 70 miles away, and where the bishop's office was. And I drove up to his office and went in. I had an appointment. And I walked into his office, and I noticed that on his desk were my records. They were thicker than the big book. And I don't imagine most ministers' records are quite that thick. And I said to him, Bishop, my purpose in coming is to see if you'll give me an appointment. I want a church. In fact, I said, I'd like to have two little churches out in the country. I'd like to get things worked out in my life. And he said to me, Ray, you're divorced, aren't you? And I said, I am. And he said, I've never given a divorced preacher a church. Now, my friends, we can think fast on our feet. And I said, Bishop, I'm about to get married. And he said, Ray, who are you going to marry? And I said, I'm going to remarry Betty. And he said, he liked Betty. And he said, you know, if you can do that, Brother Moss, I'll give you a church. Well, Betty and I wasn't even seeing each other. We hardly were even talking. And I called her up, and I invited her out, and I wined her, and I dined her, and I spent more money on her then than I had before or since. And one night when the wine was poured and the lights were dimmed, and I'm about half-crocked, I said to her, Betty, will you remarry me? Now, I want you Al-Anon folks to listen to how sick you were. In all the innocence in the world, this lady said, I will. And we did. And I had my district superintendent to perform the wedding because I wanted the bishop to get the word that it was done. And I had my two children stand up for us. And my son-in-law was there. Now, lest you think I was totally crazy, I didn't buy new rings. I had kept the old ones. And we were remarried. What an experience in itself. I tell you, what an experience. To believe that we were going to do it. And I knew that I was. I wasn't going to ever drink another drop. And they gave me three churches. Well, you know, that's a drinking man's paradise. I went out to that little place. I said, I'm going to stay sober. I did for about 2 months. Presbyterian brother down the street, layperson, said to me one day, Sunday afternoon before Labor Day Monday, he said, Reverend, we're having a party over at our house tomorrow. Do you drink? I said, well, Richard, I do once in a while. And we went over the next day, and they carried me home. And for the next 3 years, I didn't stop drinking. And in those 3 years, some terrible things happened. Took me a long time to get those amends made. I preached to people drunk. I administered the sacrament of the Lord's Supper drunk. I married young people that are buried people and married people that I didn't even know died or got married. Took me a long time to make those amends. The people would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you in a while. These people over here at this church. And I'd say, well, brother, I've been visiting over here at this church. And these people over here would say, well, Reverend, we haven't seen you lately. And I said, well, I've been visiting over here in this church. And you know what I was doing is laying up down at the lake drunk. You know, you don't take your example of your minister from me. Your minister probably has no problems like I had. The end came, as it always does, did for me. I had been in psychiatric hospitals twice. You know, it's easy to be crazy. Nobody wants you to be drunk. Nobody wants you to be an alcoholic. My bishop didn't want me to be an alcoholic. But he didn't mind my being crazy as hell. He just didn't mind my being crazy. They'd tolerate my going to the psychiatric hospital, but they would not in any way, could not have ever handled my drinking as a problem. I'd been in psychiatric hospitals two times. They hadn't helped me. I always got pretty well when I got there and got detoxed. But I called up the psychiatrist and I said to him, Doctor, I'm drinking too much. I'd been seeing him 10 years. I'd never told him I had a drinking problem. He didn't know it. And I began to explain what was happening to me. He said, why don't you just come on over here to the hospital, which was about 50 miles away, and I'll put you in for an extended stay. Well, it hadn't worked twice. I don't know why I thought it'd work the next time. But I did go. You know, if you've never been to a psychiatric hospital, you ought to go. Just for the hell of it, even if you're sober, you ought to just go see what goes on. You know, they don't know what to do with us. I show up out of my mind, totally insane, and in about 3 days, I'm a normal human being. Now, they really have staff meetings about that. And I got well. They put me on their staff. I thought they did. At least I began to do things, and they didn't refer to me as doctor or anything, but the doctor did say, now, you know, Ray, you're doing so well. We're going to give you a pass. Uh-oh. You know what happens to an alcoholic in a psychiatric hospital who gets a pass? Now, he said, don't get in any trouble. Come on back in now before bedtime. Well, I'd go out to the bar. I'd buy me a couple of fifths and bring them back in. I drank more alcohol in that psychiatric hospital than I did on the outside. And one day they had about 15 adolescents in that unit, and I was the old man. I was 48 years old, and I was the old man, and I was kind of cool, laid back. And I said to the staff, if you'll get some buckets, we'll take these young people, I will, outside. It snowed real big in February, and I said, I'll take them out, and we'll get some snow cream. Or get some snow, we'll make snow cream. They'd never heard of that, and they thought that would be terrifically therapeutic. So I got all 15 of those kids together, got them on the elevator with the buckets, went outside in the snow. Nobody could get into the hospital. The snow was so heavy. Well, these kids got in a little circle out there, sat down in the snow. And they fired up something, started smoking it, got me right in the middle, gave it to me, and I smoked it too. We began to fly up on the 12th story. And I like to never got them all back together. But it did, got them inside. And then it was from that moment on that I began to realize that I had a problem, a serious problem. So I told the nurse I need to talk to the doctor, and I was drinking. And I called him, or she called him, and I talked with him. I said to him, Dr. Hurdle, I'm drinking more alcohol here than I could outside. And I'm doing some other things that are making me crazy. And he said, Ray, that can't be true. I'm the chief of staff, and that doesn't happen in our hospital. Next morning, he came down to see me, and I'd already had a couple of shooters, and I blew my breath in his face, and he discharged me. I went back home to an old, empty house. Nobody there. Everybody left. And I swore to God that if I ever had a chance the next day, that was on a Sunday. North Carolina's dry. I said, if I can get to the liquor store tomorrow, I'll never be without it again. And I went to the bank, got all the money we had, borrowed all I could, and I bought everything that I needed for the rest of my life, and I wasn't going to ever be sober again. Now, let me tell you, when it gets dark enough, you can see the stars, and a miracle happened. The only two people in the world that would have anything to do with me, my wife and a Methodist minister friend, got together. Now, God got them together, I know that, the God of my understanding. And they came up with the name of an old boy about 50 miles away who had quit drinking. I don't think they knew how he'd quit drinking, but he had quit. And they called him. He came and got me, and he took me on a 12-step trip. He got me in his car, and I remember what he said to me as we started out. I'm drunk, but I can remember a few things. He never scolded me. He never told me what I ought to do or how I ought to do it. He just simply told me what had happened to him. Well, he said he quit drinking. Well, I knew he had been drinking. I had a lot to drink with him across the years. But he didn't drink anymore. He went to AA, and I listened to him. And he got me to the hospital where they're going to detox me. I woke up the next morning, didn't know where I was. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I woke up and didn't know where I was. I knew I was in a hospital. I'd been in many of them. I'd been in hospitals all across the country, but Didn't know exactly which one I was in. Kind of looked to me like it was a state hospital. There wasn't much going on. Wasn't a newspaper in the room. There wasn't a television there. And I thought, as soon as somebody walks in here, I'm going to ask them so that they won't know that I don't know, but I want to know where I am. And a little nurse walked in, a beautiful little uniform on, and I said to her, "Honey, can you tell me where I am?" And these are the words she said to me. She said, "Reverend Moss, when you were my mom and daddy's preacher, and I wanted to die, I said, 'Honey, for God's sakes, tell me where I am and who my doctor is.' Because I knew if I knew where I was and who the doctor was, I could get out of that place." And she said, "Well, you're in Asheboro, North Carolina, and the doctor is Dr. Bob W." And I thought, it's all been a nightmare, because it was 19 years prior to that date that Dr. Bob W., had given me that sleeping capsule that started me into my drinking again. But it wasn't a nightmare. And the next morning he came, and he sat down on the side of the bed. He stuck his hand out and put it in mine, and this is what he said. He said, "Ray, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Bob, and I know how you feel." Nobody ever told me that before. Old Bob that took me down there had told me that he knew how I felt. But now here's another man saying he knows how I feel. And he said to me, "I'm going to send you to a treatment program." And he did. I stayed for a while. They helped me understand one thing. And I used to work in a treatment program for a long time for alcoholism. But they helped me understand one thing, and that's about all they can help you understand. They helped me understand there's an outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous that can help me get sober if I want it. Now, they helped me understand the disease concept. I got well in a week. You know, most of us do. I got well, and I was ready to go, and I went up to my counselor's office and said to her, "Dorothy, I'm leaving, and I want to thank you. I've left all the 12 steps on my desk back there, and they're worked and ready to go." And so I just wanted to get out of there, but I couldn't think of a soul that'd come get me. And she said to me, "Ray, you're sicker than anybody I've ever seen. I want you to go on down to your room, and I want you to think about it." And as I started down the hallway, she stuck her head out and said, "Pray about it." And I said, "You too, lady," and walked on. And when I got back to the room, two things happened in my mind that I had drunk myself to sleep over many a night trying to forget. God was working in my life. The first of them was this. I remembered that one morning, about 5 years prior to that date, that I had gotten up and gotten myself dressed to go to an AA meeting or to a Methodist men's meeting. I was going to be a speaker. I'd been drunk the night before. I'd probably been drunk. I was still drunk. And I got in my automobile, dressed, and pulled up to a stoplight that was red. And when it turned green, I turned left. And I heard a bump about like that, and I thought I'd run over a rock in the road. And I opened the door in a half turn and looked back, and there was a guy lying in the road. And I jumped out of the car. First thought was, this man has walked in front of me. And I had turned left in front of a big motorcycle, and this young man was bleeding in convulsions, and every bone I could see was broken. Facial bones were crushed. I sat there and sobered up, holding him in my hands, praying to God that he wouldn't die. Police came, the ambulance came. He lived 6 months, but I fed his children, and I clothed his children for 6 months. The guilt was there. I knew I was drunk. Nobody else knew it. Another thought came to me, back to back with that one. One morning, a few years prior to that, my son, who was about 17 years old at that time, woke me up, shook me awake out of a drunken stupor, and said, "Dad, you know what you did last night?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "You slapped Mama. I loaded my gun, and I was going to kill you, but Mama wouldn't let me. You see, I only prayed that my daddy would die, and I had anguish and pain across the years. It wouldn't have mattered to me if he'd have killed me, but what would it have done to his life?" And I got up, went back to that lady's office, and said, "I'll stay." And I did stay.
March 24th, 1980, I walked out of that treatment program, went up to my superintendent's office, 75 miles away. I was going to take those churches back. I was going to be a good minister. I walked in his office, and he said, "The bishop and I have decided, Ray, that we're going to put you on leave of absence." Now, unless you think differently, they fired me, and they should have. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to stay. I'd exhausted all of my resources, and I'd lost the will to live. I drove 16 miles down the road to my little hometown where my mother lived, and I'm 49 years old. I swallowed all the pride I'd ever had, walked in that door and sat down in her living room and said to her, "Mama, can I live with you for a while?" And she said, "You can, in the back bedroom, if you don't drink." That night, I went to an AA meeting, the first meeting I'd ever been to outside of treatment. It was my choice to go. Nobody was taking me in a van that night. I drove up in front of that little meeting, Kannapolis group. 16 people there. If they'd have asked me any questions at all, I'd have left. They never asked me where my wife was. They never asked me where I was working. They never asked me where I was living. They didn't ask anything. They just said, "We're glad to have you." And they gave me 16 phone numbers and said, "Call us if you need us." And I did. And I stayed sober. I got me a sponsor in that group. He's still my sponsor. I've gone back to Kannapolis. We just retired 5 weeks ago, and we moved back to that little town. Got us a house there. Bought a meal house. Doesn't have a pantry, but we built a bathroom on it that could be considered a pantry. I got me a sponsor, and George has never told me to do a thing. He's always showed me what to do. He always carried me to a meeting. I said to Betty, I believe George needs more meetings than anybody I know. I stayed sober. Had to make amends. Had to make amends to Betty. I learned the greatest lesson that I've ever learned in my 62 years one night at Burger King. I talked to my sponsor about it, and I really didn't know how to make those amends, but he told me how. He said, "You just write them down, and you go and you share them with her." And I wrote them all down, had them in my back pocket. Didn't have a place to go and meet with her, but we went to Burger King after a meeting. She was riding with me to meeting. She wasn't sitting close anymore, but she's riding with me. And we came back from that meeting and stopped at Burger King. I took the list out of that back pocket and laid it up on the desk there at that little table. Told her what I was doing. She knew what I was doing. She'd been in Al-Anon longer than I'd been around the AA. And I sat there and I said, "Betty, I want to make my amends to you. I want to ask you to forgive me for all the things that I did wrong to you and harmed you." And she reached across the table and took my hands in hers and squeezed them and looked me straight in the eye and said to me, "Ray, it's okay. It's been okay. We talk about them, laugh about them, but it's been okay." I learned how to forgive, and I learned how to accept forgiveness. I tried for 38 years to preach forgiveness, and I didn't know how to do it. But this lady taught me what Al-Anon taught her, and she said, "It's okay. It has been." My dad got sober. Age 74. He called me. Remember, he drank alcoholically 62 years. He called me one day, and I'm living in South Carolina, and he said, "I need to see you." And I drove up there to his home. He's a periodic, and he'd been drunk 3 months, and he didn't weigh 130 pounds, drunk on the couch. Wasn't working for him anymore. He said to me, "I need some help, son. I'm sick." And I said, "I'll get the doctor." And he said, "No, I need some help with my drinking." He had never admitted that. And I threw his little butt in my car. Took him to a VA hospital, put him in a treatment program. He stayed 3 months. They let him out, and he got sober. I gave him every chip he picked up. What a wonderful experience. I hated him. I prayed that God would let him die, and I had the privilege to walk with him in sobriety, he and I together. Conversations we talked about. We laughed, we cried, had a wonderful time. 9 months sober, he called me. Stand at my sister's house. said, I need to see you, and I need to see you today. And I said, I can't come till tomorrow. And I drove up to his house. He's sitting there with a coffee pot made, had a list on the table. I knew what he was going to do. He got to make amends to me. He reached his little gnarled arthritic hands across the table, took mine, tears running down his cheeks. He said to me, I want to apologize for all the hurt that I caused you. And I said exactly what Betty said to me to him. Tears in our eyes, I said, it's okay. By God, it was okay. Has been okay. He died a couple of years ago. He got sober on the 1st of September, and on the August 29th, he died, and I wasn't able to give him a chip. But I'd been to see him a week before that and told him I was going to bring a meeting to the hospital because he couldn't come to a meeting. And he died, and I already bought the chip. Funeral home, when there wasn't anybody around, I went over to where his body was in the casket, and I took that chip out, and I stuck it in his pocket. I took him by his hand, and I said to him, Daddy, you're cold sober. He would have liked that. He would have liked it. Let me tell you about my first birthday. If you can't remember your first birthday, my sponsor says you're in trouble. I can remember mine. I can't remember some of the others, but I can sure enough remember my first one. 365 days without a drink. Saturday night, my home group, 200 people there. I thought they all came to see me get a chip, but they really came to an AA meeting. And let me tell you who was there, a significant bunch of people. My wife was there, my son was there, my daughter was there, her husband, my mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister, brother-in-law. Those people that were, and my mother, those people who were so important in my life were there to see me pick up a chip. Bob, who did the 12-step call, came and shared his message for me. I picked up my chip, the applause stopped, and I looked around. I couldn't find my son. He was a strapping submariner, the Navy. I knew where he was, but I couldn't find him. See, I taught him just exactly what my daddy taught me, that men don't cry and men don't hug each other. And I went outside, and I looked down across the parking lot, and there he stood in the light. I went toward him, and he came toward me. The closer we got, the faster we got, and I put my arms out. And the first time that I'd hugged him since he was a little boy, we wrapped our arms around each other, cried together, and he said to me, a boy that was going to kill me a few years prior to that, you're the best daddy in the whole world. You know what it took for me to get that? Don't drink. Go to meetings. Study the big book. Listen to your sponsor and help your sponsor work with other alcoholics. And that's what it took. And I haven't been doing anything different since. I really haven't. I've been putting a little more quality into what I'm doing, but it's the same thing. Betty and I have a good life today. I couldn't find a job. It's hard for a drunk preacher to find a job. I tell you, it's hard. I'd go around looking for a job, and people would say, what you been doing in these 25 years? There's a blank hole there. And I said, well, I've been preaching. And they'd say, well, brother, we're not hiring preachers today. I found a job in a cotton mill, third shift. That's 11 to 7, 11 at night, 7 in the morning. Running big old machines called cards. I hadn't worked in years. But that's where God wanted me. Worked there 9 months. I'd like to stay there forever. I had no responsibilities. I just showed up and ran those machines. Did a pretty good job with them. Never missed a day's work. Got to go to a lot of AA meetings. Didn't have to worry about it. Just went all the time. Went to retreats. Had a wonderful time. Betty and I just walked around town, picked up cans. Had a good time. I'd like to have done it forever, but you know, when you get responsible, responsibilities come back to you. And a fellow offered me a job, and then I had to take another job and another job. And my profession, I thought I'd never get it back. I was 3 years sober and living over at Daytona Beach and working in a treatment program there. Didn't know how to make amends to those church people that I'd offended and harmed. Wished I could, but didn't know how. God does for us, you know, what we can't do for ourselves. I read in the Daytona paper, newspaper, that the bishop of the Methodist Church, who had been in North Carolina when I was the craziest that I'd been, was now the bishop there in Florida. I wrote him a letter. I tried to explain to him what I wanted to do. I wanted to come over and talk with him at Lakeland to tell him about all the offensive things that I'd done in the congregation, that I couldn't go back there. I'd asked one of the ministers to let me come back, stand up in the pulpit, and make a general confession to them. And he said, "Hell no. You've done enough damage here already." So I wrote the bishop a long letter, and he didn't understand what I wanted. He wrote me a letter back and said, "Ray, you don't owe me an apology, but I'd like to see you, and I'm so glad to know you're still alive." I went over to Lakeland and saw him. I sat there with him for over 4 hours, and I told him, I did a fifth step with him. I told him everything that I'd ever done. I talked about adultery committed, crimes done, stealing done, wrongs done, drinking, all of those things. And he had a prayer afterwards. And then he said, "Ray, I've never seen that kind of honesty in all of my years in the church." And I said to him, "Well, Bishop, that's just two steps out of AA's 12. They called me from my annual conference, and I was 3 years sober. And they said, "We want you to come back to the church, full connection." And I took it. And I've been doing workshops and seminars, and I've been working with ministers from that conference in North Carolina. I've been working with ministers' wives and ministers' children. I've been trying to help them understand that alcoholism is a disease. It's a family disease, and it affects everybody. And I have respect. And this past June, they retired, Betty and I, honorably from the Western North Carolina Conference of the Methodist Church. Just a little over 13 years ago, they didn't know what to do with us. But they honorably retired us. Had a wonderful experience. Well, God's got a lot of things for us to do. We just retired from one job, going back to Kannapolis to do some other jobs, other things that he's got for us to do. AA is a wonderful place to be. I have a great time every day. I haven't had a down day since I've been sober. I have rebounded to a height far greater than that which I fell from. Now, I've had some bad times. There was a time in our sobriety that Betty and I, three times, that we both have been without jobs. No work, no income coming in. Well, we didn't have any trouble with it. We just made love and picked up cans. I'd like for that to have lasted forever, but it stopped too. I got a little grandson who's 9 years old. About a year ago, when he was 3 years old, let me tell you a couple of things about him, because he may have the characteristics. All the males on my dad's side are alcoholics, got a problem. He was hearing us say the little slogans around our house, and he comes stay with us. And one morning I was leaving to go to work, and he came to the door, and I started out, and I said, "Bye, Darrell." And he said, "Papa, be easy." He hadn't quite got it, but he was working on it. About a year ago, this little second grader, the good reader, was riding me. He and I like to ride together, and I tell him some things. You know, he likes me to tell him stories of the old days. And I was talking with him, and he picked up, I carry a big book in the same place I used to carry a bottle. He picked up my big book, and he said, "Papa, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Yes, it is." I said, "Why don't you turn over to this particular page?" And showed him where it was, and I said, "Now, start reading there." And he began to read how it works, and he read down through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he and I talked about AA. You see, what I've done for him now, I've opened the door. If he ever needs us, he knows where we are. He knows what we are. I want to close by telling you this story. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the grace of God that brought me here. I had nothing to do with it. Few people worked that miracle, but God directed it. And when I got to AA, AA has kept me sober. and given me serenity and peace and joy and happiness. But you know, I've had to work for it. I'm going to tell you, and you know this as well as I know, you can't come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down and expect it to happen. It won't happen that way. Or you'll stay sober if you keep coming to meetings. But you got to work to grow. Reminds me of a little story. Mama was getting a little six-year-old kid ready to go to school. First time. Dressed him up. School bus was coming. She put him on a brand new pair of sneakers, new pair of pants, shirt and a tie. Had a little jacket on. Hair was combed in place. She walked him down the driveway, stood there, waited till the bus come. He hopped on the bus, and she started crying, turned around, went back to the house. She waited patiently, and until 2 o'clock came, she walked down that driveway waiting on the bus. The bus came. The little boy jumped off. Now, he didn't look like he did when he got on. He lost a shoe. His pants were torn. His shirt was ripped. He didn't have his jacket. His hair was standing straight on his head, and he had two big old black eyes. And his mama looked at him and said, "Son, who in the name of God gave you those black eyes?" That little fellow squared his shoulders and stuck his chest out and looked her straight in the eye and said to her, "Mama, they don't give those things away. You have to fight for them." Not a one of you sitting here from 53 years to 1 month, not a one of us have it because somebody gave it to us. We got it because we had to work for it. Thank you for the invitation.